This week, October 20th, 2015, on The Digital Story, an interview with Sony artisan Brian Matias, adjustable color temperature LED lighting, and drone registration. All of this and more with yours truly, Derek Story, on The Digital Story. Welcome back to another Digital Story. I'm back in the studio here in Santa Rosa, California. Starting to feel a little autumn in the air, which is a good thing because we have the Fall Color Workshop coming up this weekend. I'll tell you a little bit more about how that went in next week's show. But this week, I have a special treat for you. We have an interview with a Sony artisan photographer, Brian Matias, and it's really good. I mean, it's super enjoyable. He's like a photographer's photographer, and I think you'll really enjoy that. We're also going to talk about LED lighting. I have been touching base with this off and on, and have been moving my own business toward using LED lighting for my commercial shoots. And the latest light that I have is what they call bicolor, which allows me to adjust the color temperature between a range of 3200 and 5600 Kelvin. Very interesting stuff. We'll talk a bit about that because that is good stuff. And then, of course, I have lots of other bits and bobs, including the weekly update. I think we should get going here. The weekly update. DP Review reports FAA reportedly developing mandatory drone registration system. The U.S. government may soon require most drones to be registered, according to the Associated Press. Sources speaking on the matter state that the FAA is working with unspecified industry and government officials to create a registration system. While the exact requirements aren't known, it is believed that small and toy drones will not require registration. The requirement would help officials track operators who do not follow appropriate regulations. The FAA reportedly wants the registration requirement implemented before Christmas, as it is anticipated hundreds of thousands of drones will be sold. The FAA is less concerned with the lightweight drones that can't fly above a few hundred feet, as they are not as risky as heavier, more powerful drones. And that is, of course, from DP Review. I have the links in the show notes. And I think, you know, this is one of those it's going to happen sort of things. We are seeing stories, more stories, about drones interfering with rescue operations and getting in flight paths and all that sort of stuff. And since they are up in the air with everything else that's up in the air, then they probably need to be registered just like the other things flying around above our heads. And maybe just bring a little bit of sanity to the situation. In other news, Live GIF app easily turns your iPhone's live photos into GIFs and videos. And this is compliments of Imaging Resource. And they report, rather than relying on the support of a few social networks, Live GIF lets you easily turn your photo/video hybrid into an animated GIF or video to share with the world across social media. The process is simple. Open Live GIF, select the live photo you want to convert, choose whether you want it as a GIF or a video file, and you're done. Saving and sharing is done via iOS's baked-in share sheet. So I downloaded this app. It's $1.99. because I like the live photo feature on my iPhone 6S. And, you know, on one hand, I think Live GIF is cool because it does allow me to take a live photo and share it with somebody that doesn't have an iPhone 6S or El Capitan running photos for OS X. It allows me to share that image with them. The problem is with it, and I'll be honest with you, is that the converted GIF or the converted video, I've tried both, doesn't look the same as the live photo. The color isn't as good, the sharpness isn't as good, and the motion is different. For some reason, when I look at the live photo, yeah, there's a little bit of incidental movement and so forth, and then there's the image thing. With the conversion, it just feels like the phone is more jittery or something. I don't know. It's not the same. Now, on images, and I'll run a sample. I'll run a sample in the show notes. I have a good bobblehead shot that I took a picture of, the Iguodala bobblehead shot from the other night at the Warriors game. So I'll show that because I thought that was a good example. When you hold the phone super steady, like in that case, I had it resting on a table when I took the photo, then it works better. But the handheld stuff, and I have a pretty steady hand, the handheld stuff was a little disappointing. Now, you don't have a whole lot to risk here. I'm still glad I bought it. It's $1.99 because it does allow me to show an approximation of the live photo. And I can put it on Facebook or a website or Twitter or whatever. But I will warn you, it's not exactly the same as the live photo that you look at on your iPhone 6S. And that is this week's weekly update. Story number one, adjustable color temperature LED lighting. So I've incorporated the Dracast LED 500 Pro bi-color LED light into my commercial work. And I love it. I just love it. It was a good investment. It cost me a few bucks. I got it on super sale for $399 at B&H, normally $695. And even the $399 was, you know, that's something you think about. But it is such a good light. And when I was first looking into bi-color LEDs, I didn't really understand them. Because I thought, okay, you either have a cool color or a warm color, and you get to switch back and forth. And you do have cool tubes in the panel, and you do have warm tubes in the panel. In fact, they alternate on the panel. But the trick is that you have an adjuster knob on the back that allows you to go from warm, in this case, 3200K, and then as you turn the dial, you go from warm to cool, which is 5600K, which isn't really, I mean, that's not really cool. That's daylight balanced, but cool compared to warm, if you know what I mean. So what you really have is, you know, a lot of color variations. And this is, I love this. I have to tell you, I just absolutely love it. So what I have been using these bi-color LEDs for is my commercial work. I have a lot of shoots for commercial clients where I'm inside their office building, I'm inside a conference room, I'm inside an event center with some kind of funky ambient lighting. And they almost always want, you know, something, you know, the background in the shot, because it'll have their corporate logo or it'll be an event or, you know, whatever they're trying to do, whatever story they're trying to tell. So when I had just the white LEDs, the 5500 LEDs, I could get a very nice color temperature on my subject for the environmental portrait. And then the background would go warm on me because it was almost always some type of warm lighting in the background, tungsten or whatever. And it was difficult. It was, I would put filters over the white LEDs and I would do all sorts of things, try to work near open windows, whatever I could to bring those color temperatures together. Now, with these bi-color LED panels, all I have to do is adjust the knob on the back of the panel to the same color temperature that's, you know, predominant in the room, shoot at that, shoot in RAW, use a custom white balance profile, and I'm done. Everything is in balance. Everything is in alignment. And if I have to make an adjustment to the color balance, it's all kind of hanging together. I'm not dealing with these different light sources. And it just makes things so much easier. The problem I've had with filters over the years, putting filters over flashes or filters over LEDs, that it's still hard for me to match the output from my light with the ambient lighting in the room. you could come close, and you could definitely come closer than, you know, the white 5600K light that's coming out of the LED. But I had a hard time, you know, getting it spot on. Now with this dial on the back, what I've been doing is been holding up a sheet of white paper, letting the LED light illuminate the paper, and just turning the dial until the color temperature looks about the same as the other objects in the room. I've just been eyeballing it, and it's been coming out great because I can just go back and forth, and really be very precise, because I have everything between 3200K and 5600K. I have every variation. Now, the way that it works is, of course, that when you're at the 3200K end, only the warm tubes are illuminating. And when you're at the 5600K end, only the white tubes. But then as you are working in between with the dial, then there are varying degrees of the two different tubes. So like when you're right in the middle, let's say between 3200 and 5600, then you have equal amounts of the warm tubes and the white tubes illuminated at the same time. It is so smart. It is so cool. Cool in a sense of neat. Not have to be careful when you're talking about, you know, warm and cool colors and all that. And it's just intelligent. And then, of course, LED lighting, it's cool in another way, and that is not hot. Oh, my gosh, I really need to get away from the C word, don't I? And it's easy on the subjects. It doesn't heat up the room. It's terrific. And then when you go with the higher-end LED units, like this Dracast LED 500, they don't flicker. It's a nice steady light, so you don't have to worry about, you know, odd color shifts or anything like that. I got the unit with the barn doors and a battery. The battery's huge on it. It'll go for hours and hours and hours. And then, of course, I can also plug it into the wall. I used it the other day. Last week I had a shoot for Credit Union up here in Santa Rosa. And I was putting this LED light inside of cars and inside office buildings and everywhere. And, you know, with the battery, you can prop it up just about any way you want. And it was working so well. It has that kind of bright output. It's still not as bright as a speed light. When I was in brighter sunlight outside, I still had to use my speed lights because I needed, you know, that power that they have, that big output. That's still more light output than even the professional LEDs. So in bright sunlight, I still have to use the speed lights for fill. But for everything else, I've been using the LEDs, and the bicolor is great. Of course, now the problem is I want all of my LED lights to be bicolor. I have one bicolor unit right now, and then I still have the 5500K units. So we'll see how that goes. You know, I can only invest so much at a time. But I wanted to explain it to you in case you were having the same sort of thoughts that I was, that we're really just dealing with two colors, you know, on a bicolor LED. And you're not. You're dealing with a whole range that's between 3200 and 5600K. There's a lot of different companies making these things. And I just think they're fantastic. And if you're looking for lighting for video or portraiture, these things are pretty fun. I'm hooked. Like I said, I still carry speed lights because there are instances where I need them. But when I can, I'm using the LEDs. Story number two, interview with Sony artisan Brian Matias. Brian is a terrific guy, I have to tell you. He's a Sony artisan. And the reason why I wanted to have him on the show is that you know how much I love mirrorless photography. But I use Olympus and Panasonic primarily. And I know quite a bit about Fujifilm. And I have a Samsung mirrorless. But I don't shoot Sony. And I really wanted to get someone on who was a Sony expert so we could talk about Sony cameras. Brian was able to do that. And that's what we're doing. So I'm not going to do much more setup here other than I enjoy talking with Brian, and we covered both, you know, the transition to mirrorless and got to talk about Sony. Yay, because Sony's really shaking it up in the industry right now. So let's sit back and enjoy this interview with Brian, and then I'll come back on afterwards. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Derek.
So our listeners know a little bit more about who you are if they don't already. Just give us a little background with your involvement in Sony and also just you as a photographer. You've been shooting for a long time.
Yeah. My name is Brian Matiash, and I would consider myself a landscape and travel photographer, as well as a published author, because my first book just released electronically. And so that's who I am. With Sony, though, I kind of have two kind of relationships with them. The first is I'm a member of their Artisans of Imagery program, which is a group of a little over 40 photographers, U.S.-based, who are kind of brand ambassadors. And then I also work with Sony behind the scenes, helping them with content and social strategy. We recently launched a website called Alpha Universe, and we share original content that helps, you know, promote photography, the love of photography and videography for not just Sony users, but for just artists in general.
That's awesome. I love the Sony Artisan group. You know, at a lot of times at trade shows, some of the best talks on the floor are, you know, from that group. And it's very exciting, the program they put together. You know, here's the thing. I talk a lot about mirrorless on this show. I have a thing going called Nimble Photographer. But I'm mainly a Micro Four Thirds guy. And this is a real opportunity because I've been dying to have someone from the Sony camp here so we can really talk about these amazing cameras that Sony has been producing. Tell me a little bit about how did you, you know, was it because of Sony you got into mirrorless? How, you know, let's talk a little bit about that, then we'll talk about the gear itself a bit.
For sure. My first, very, very first foray into mirrorless lasted a couple of days when I think it was the first Olympus digital pen came out. And I was excited because I, from the beginning up until a couple of years ago, I was exclusively a Canon shooter and I used their DSLR. So when the pen came out, I got it. And this was years ago. This was, let's call it 5 or 6 years or whenever it came out. I ordered it on Amazon and I tried it out and it was really quick because I was coming from big system to something much more svelte, the differences were really glaring, so much so that I returned it back to Amazon. That was kind of my initial foray into mirrorless Micro Four Thirds, like wipe my hands, no. Thanks, you know, see you again. You know, over the years, Olympus, Panasonic, Fuji were releasing their stuff, and even Sony, they had their mirrorless kind of like APS-C sensor cameras. I own the Fuji, X100?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it
mm-hmm.
was the integrated system. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like their retro looking. It got a bunch of buzz.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was their first one, yes.
Exactly. That's what kind of led them on. So I tried that, wasn't happy with it. It was riddled with issues. And so again, back to DSLR. Sony got on my radar initially when they started releasing these really like off the wall products. Like they had this QX series, the QX10 and the QX100, which is literally a lens and a sensor that pairs to a phone. I guess the most comparable thing today is the DX01, which is for iPhones. You know, it leverages the phone as the viewfinder, and then it uses more robust optics and digital sensors. And then they also released their RX1. Which was the first full-frame mirrorless camera with an integrated lens. Yeah. And coincidentally, yesterday, they just announced the success, or one of the successors to that line, the RX1R Mark II. Very, very much a mouthful. So when I started seeing that, Derek, that's what it takes, at least for me, for a company to get on my radar. Trying to not reinvent the wheel, it's not another 5D Mark IV, big deal. Okay, great. trying to do different things. Yeah, I mean, that's what it is in our industry. It's like, okay, we are photographers of a digital ilk, and we're bound to hardware. Whereas up until, 20 years ago, when digital cameras first began to be affordable for consumers, we were all kind of, for the most part, photographers had the same barriers to entry in terms of you had your film, you had your SLR camera or your rangefinder, or a medium format or large format. But you were all doing essentially the same things. Now, being tied to hardware, and because your image quality can also be married to hardware so intimately, I looked at companies that were trying to change things up. All the stuff that I mentioned, though, didn't make me Canon, because I wasn't going to sacrifice having a lens system. And so when Sony announced the A7, and not only did they announce the A7 and like three native lenses, but their marketing campaigns were really heavily touting the ability to adapt your existing lenses. So I was a Canon shooter. Announcement of a full frame mirrorless system wasn't exciting enough. The fact that the company was also kind of saying, no, listen, use your 17 millimeter tilt shift lens or your 15 millimeter mm-hmm. fisheye lens. That's great.
Well, in a sense, we both know they kind of had to do that, because even though they had a very exciting camera body in the A7 series that has grown since, beautifully, their lens roadmap was very early in the journey.
Yes.
There. And they did not have a lot of native lenses. And they were going, when you're going up against Panasonic and Olympus, who've been cranking out lenses now for a number of years, they needed to come up with something to tide over the photographers until they could get their native lenses coming out, which they are now. Now the Sony lens roadmap's looking very nice. But I think they had to do that in the beginning, to satisfy.
Absolutely right. And it was smart. I mean, mm-hmm. think about it, Derek. Let's say you're interested in this, and your cost of transition is $1,500 versus $1,500 plus an extra anywhere from, 5 to 10 grand for new lenses.
Mm-hmm.
That's that was exactly, Derek, my transition. I was like, all right, well, I'm just going to go with the A7, warts and all, because it wasn't a perfect system, but it was significantly lighter and smaller, still gave me a full frame sensor. I think it was the same megapixel count, if not slightly more than the 5D Mark III. I can't remember. Yeah, it was. And that was also, companion to the A7R at the time, which was a larger sensor camera. So for about 6-7 months, I was using my Canon lenses exclusively. I didn't even buy a Sony lens.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at the Sony approach to mirrorless, is it the full frame that attracts you? Is it easier for you to go from a high-end Canon system to the Sony system because there are fewer compromises? What's that attraction for you? Because I think it's interesting the direction that different photographers go when they make these choices.
And it's funny that you bring that up, because I can flip that question on you or on anyone,
mm-hmm.
where you're saying the attraction of a high-end DSLR system to Sony, where if you're a look at the lineup today, I would challenge you to tell me how is it whatever Canon or Nikon are offering, how are they more high end than what Sony's offering? And of course, listen, I understand there are certain things about a big robust system that is, better weather sealing and a larger chassis means you have better heat dissipation, which means you can have a higher frame rate. Because the more frames mm-hmm. you take, the harder the sensor gets. I understand that. Listen, there are still ways to evolve. But when you see the advancements in the Sony lineup, and I know it's kind of easy for me to say, I'm calling it as it is. I'm not like doing this because I have such a strong relationship with Sony. This is simply kind of observation.
Yeah, this is where your passion is.
Yeah, like a camera. Okay, you have this camera, palm-sized camera, that has things like, well, one, full-frame sensor, two, five-axis in-body image stabilization. So now you have image stabilization no matter what lens you have. 3, in-body 4K recording. 4, beautiful electronic viewfinder. That my favorite memory was, I was in Iceland with two of my buddies. Two of us were are Sony shooters, and actually the other one, he's an artisan as well. And then the third one was with his Canon 5D Mark III. We're shooting auroras. So it's dark, dark, dark. The two of us, the two Sony shooters, we both had our A7Ss, which are, you know, low light monsters. So we just cranked up our ISOs to essentially made the camera, it looked like it was daylight. So we were able to compose in 2 seconds, ensure focus, get all that stuff, and then readjust settings. While our buddy was taking the photo, waiting the 20, 30 seconds, seeing if the composition's good, readjusting. There's no argument there when I look at what Sony's doing versus what others are doing. And really, it's getting to the point where how long it's been since Canon and Nikon have gone on unanswered in this kind of smack in the face.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. I think the innovation is happening on the mirrorless side. I mean, that's where we're seeing the real strides forward in what we can do with our cameras. I mean, I absolutely agree. I mean, that's why I'm so attracted to it, because it's exciting compared to, I shoot Canon also. And, you know, I really haven't seen anything that has, you know, got my blood going for some time from them.
That's a perfect way to, Derek, that's perfect. Like, mm-hmm. If I were to have to summarize it, it's, of course I love photography, and you do too, and I'm sure everyone who's listening, you know, is passionate about photography. But when you can get excited about the camera you hold in your hand, not just like because you know you're out taking photos, but because of what the hardware, the technology can afford you. You know, it's funny because my wife is also a working professional photographer. We've been trying, you know, me and my colleagues at Sony, we would love to get her on board at Sony, but she's actually moving into Fuji's camp with the X-T1 that we talked about just mm-hmm. a bit ago. And her reasoning is kind of the same as mine, just kind of in a different pivot, where she wants the camera to make her feel good the way about how she uses it. And because of the X-T1's aesthetics and their choice to put dials for all the key settings, that makes her, you know, she comes from a film background as well, and she appreciates having those controls. She's sticking with Fuji.
Absolutely.
Also a mirror.
I think what happens is, you know, what you're talking about, what happens for her, and definitely what happens for me, is that if I'm excited about the hardware, if I really like it, and you know, and it, to me, I just admire what they've done, then I want to go take pictures. Then I'll go out and take pictures just so I can hold that camera in my hand and use it. And so therefore, I'm shooting more often than I would if I didn't care about the camera. You know, I know people go, hey, the gear is only the gear, and it's, you know, it's all about the art and the vision. Yeah, I totally understand that. But you know what? If something motivates me to go out and be creative, then I'm all for that too. And that's what's happening with me. And it sounds like that's what's happening with you and your wife too.
Absolutely. And you know what? I don't really have much patience for people who, kind of this almost, you know, kumbaya, like it's not about the gear, it's about the passion. Listen, okay? You can say it's not about the gear when you find someone who's like never took a photo in their life, and they're like, oh, I'm gonna go buy a top end camera and you know, all the top end lenses, like putting the cart in front of the horse. That's an appropriate time to say, you know what, it's really right now, it's not about the gear. You should focus on figuring out what your kind of creative vision is and what your photographic style is, and mm-hmm. understanding the kind of, even beyond that, just the simple elemental lessons of photography, like the holy trinity of your aperture and your ISO and your shutter speed. But when it comes to, let's say I need to take some commercial architecture shots when I used to do that for a living, and you're going to tell me, oh, it's not about the gear, and I don't need a tilt shift lens. Okay, you know what? We've got problems. Or, hey, I'm out shooting the Aurora, and my camera can help me compose in pitch, you know, near pitch black conditions to get the photo that I want in a short amount of time so that I can get some other ones. Yeah, it is about the ear. So I get fired up when oh, you know, you don't need 42 megapixels. Well, you know what? If I'm standing, you know, 3,000 feet away from something and my longest lens is a 7200 and I need to crop in a lot to, like, you know, a 15 megapixel image, those 42 megapixels are going to count.
Yeah, they come in handy, don't they?
They sure do. So, Derek, you can see I get very, very...
Oh, it's fun. It's good. Hey, let's talk about the transition from optical viewfinder to electronic viewfinder, because it's a whole different world. I'll tell you, my thing on it. I really like electronic viewfinders, and, now especially that they've gotten a lot better. But I think they're a lot of fun, and I still shoot with optical viewfinders, of course, when I use those cameras. But when I'm using any of the mirrorless cameras, I'm not going, oh, God, I wish this thing had an optical viewfinder. I'm really enjoying electronic. And the thing I like most about is real-time exposure compensation feedback. I am just so much better with my exposures now than I was before, because I'm just rotating that exposure compensation dial and getting exactly the right thing when I click the shutter. How did that process go for you?
I agree with you 100%. I mean, for me, the one optical viewfinder that I think I always romanticize and just love are rangefinders. You know, there's something really fun about adjusting focus until both sides overlap. But when you talk about EVF, yeah, you nailed it on the head. All this feedback and information that, let's go back to Fuji, I think it's the X100. I want to say it's the X100.
It is the X100. Yeah. And then they did the S and then they did the T. Yeah. So it's the X100. That's a heck of a camera for as quirky as it is.
Yeah. It was a fun camera. I guess it still is. But they started with that kind of hybrid viewfinder. Whereas optical with this kind of like digital overlay. And, you know, when you go to EVF, so you brought up a perfect, probably the most important thing, which is the real-time feedback, exposure feedback. But there are also a lot of little things that if photographing from the rear LCD is not an option because it's too bright or you have to turn it off because you're in a dark place and you're using your EVF, having things like, you know, your spirit level or your focus points. Like, I love the few times, I'm not a portrait shooter, but when I do photograph people, you know, I love the confirmation, the visual confirmation when there's a box that goes around someone's head. And then even more so when I turn, Sony has what's called IAF, like EYEAF, where when it detects the face, it goes further and detects the eyes. Seeing that confirmation is important to me when I'm shooting with, say, the Zeiss, the Batis 85-1.8 at 1.8. I want to make sure that I'm getting the eye in focus, because I don't want to get back and, you know, see that her bangs are in focus or his mustache was in focus, not the eyes.
Yeah, you don't have a lot of leeway if you're shooting wide open with that lens.
No, you need as big of a handicap as you can. And then, you know, speaking of that, there's also like things like focus peaking, which you don't have on optical viewfinders.
I even in bright conditions even review my images through the electronic viewfinder.
Yes.
You know, that's kind of cool, and it's something I think photographers forget that they can do sometimes. But it's really nice.
That's a perfect point to make, and you're right, because oftentimes when I'm photographing someone. Or I'm photographing something and I want to show it to someone and we're out there, I'll tell them, just don't look here, look through the viewfinder.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, let's talk about lenses for a moment, because Sony's roadmap now is a lot further along. A lot of great glass coming out. Terrific partnership they have going with Zeiss. Zeiss has been on a bit of a roll themselves, I think. What's some of the glass that you recommend to people that are contemplating moving over to Sony?
So it's funny, because I had this conversation with a friend of mine just 2 days ago over lunch, and she wants to switch from her Nikon to an A7 system. And she wanted to know, like, what few lenses, if she were to invest in native lenses, to go. And so there are two schools of thought here. We have kind of the trinity of lenses. There's a 1635, a 2470, and a 7200. The first two are Zeiss Sony lenses, and the second one, or the third one, is a Sony branded lens. That gives you kind of that full focal length from 16 to 200. The thing is, they're all f4 lenses.
Mm-hmm.
The benefit to that is they're smaller and lighter. It's not pushing as much glass. So I told her that, and she said, "Well, you know," she responded exactly the way I would have hoped. She's like, "That's great, but there are times when I'm shooting in lower light and I need faster lenses." And so then it's like, "Oh, all right, well, if you want to go the prime route, there's Zeiss, the bodice lenses. Right now, the widest one is a 25 millimeter F2, which is, I have that lens and it's brilliant. You can get then the Sony Zeiss 55-1.8, which DxO marked as one of the sharpest lenses ever made, ever.
That's nice to have that label, yeah, isn't it?
It's a beautiful lens.
Yeah.
And then there's the 85 bodice. And then you can go like into other, you can go to the 7200 if you need it. But there's you've said it several times, the lens system has matured now, and it's only going to get more mature.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's safe to assume that the next round of lenses that we'll see from Sony will start attacking faster apertures, or wider apertures rather, and then also longer focal lengths.
Mm-hmm.
You have Sony's A-mount lenses, which, there's a 70 to 400, which I have, and then also have faster, like a 24 to 70, 2.8. These are bigger lenses, and you can adapt them very easily with Sony adapters. So,
have you tried that? Have you tried adapting an A-mount to your A7?
Certainly.
How's it work?
So we can even start before that with adapting the Canon stuff. And I'll say straight up, with the original A7, the reason why I went to Sony native lenses was because of how frustrated I got with that experience. It's gotten significantly better with the A7 R2 because it has many more on-sensor phase detection autofocus points.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, answer your question, it works great. I mean, there are currently two adapters that Sony makes. There's a dumb adapter, which is literally just a physical adapter that's hollow, and then there's a smart adapter that was good for the older A7 cameras because it introduced a limited phase detection autofocus system. So if you use the dumb adapter, which means you're going to rely on, and we're talking about now the A7R Mark II, you're going to rely on its autofocusing. The experience is beautiful, whether it's Canon or Sony lenses. I personally have been moving away from that just because, listen, I want to just use a native. I don't want to deal with adapters.
Yeah.
I just want native full frame E-mount. And so that's what I've been focusing on.
Well, there's sort of an arc that we go through. I mean, I went through the same thing when I started the new system. And in the beginning, because you don't have the lens collection that you want, you'll put up with adapters. And then as you get deeper into it and you have this wonderful experience with the native lenses, you just go, you know what, I just want to shoot native because, the adapters work, they're serviceable, but, there's nothing like a perfectly matched lens to a camera body for a really sweet experience.
Exactly, perfectly put.
I'm just really happy to have you on here to really talk about Sony because I just so appreciate the work that they're doing both inside the camera. Now, the sensor technology is amazing, but that they're pushing the conversation with some real innovation, and other people are gonna have to step up to the plate, and we all benefit from that. So this is.
Yes.
It's fun, isn't it?
it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right, Brian, thank you so much. Hey, where, if people want to see your stuff or learn more about you, where should they go?
You can find me on my website. It's matiash.com, M-A-T-I-A-S-H.com.
Awesome. Brian, Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure, and hopefully we'll get to talk again soon.
Thank you for having me. This is definitely a fun one, Derek. Yeah. I appreciate it.
All righty. All right. Talk to you later.
Thanks so much, Brian. That was terrific, don't you think? So now we have all the bases covered. Now we've got Sony in the mix too, as they should be because they're so popular and doing such a great job. We will continue to stretch our boundaries whenever I can find folks. But for now, it was awesome having Brian on the show today. All right, let's talk a little bit. I got a little spot here, a short spot that I want to do on uploading images directly from Lightroom to Zenfolio. I'm doing this short series on Zenfolio. And today's tip is that there are two plugins available right now to connect your Lightroom workflow to your Zenfolio site. And of course, your Zenfolio site is where you do your client fulfillment, and it's also your portfolio site or your storefront site. And having Lightroom, you know, where you can work on all your stuff, where you upload your pictures, where you import your pictures now using the new import dialog box, soon to be reverted back to the old import dialog box. Those of you that have been following that story, you know what I mean. Anyway, to be able to do your front end workflow in Lightroom and then connect directly to Zenfolio, where you're publishing stuff either to clients or for your own storefront, it's really convenient. So the two plugins right now that are available. The first one is Z Export to Zenfolio, and that's by Jeffrey Friedel. And the other, and this other one's also on the Lightroom site, called Photo Upload Zenfolio by New P Products. And that allows you to upload your photos from either Lightroom's publishing services or from the export window. So that's super convenient. It's a $10 plugin. There's also connectors for iFi, Photo Mechanic, and Windows Live Photo Gallery. So you have a lot of different ways to connect to your Zenfolio gallery and client fulfillment. You don't have to just like go through their website or whatever. You can go directly from Lightroom, directly from iFi, directly from Photo Mechanic. There was an Aperture plugin out there at one time. I wasn't able to track it down, but I'm pretty sure with a little bit more work I could. For those of you still using Aperture, I think you can go from Aperture to Zenfolio too. So anyway, just another tip, a way to integrate Zenfolio's storefront and client fulfillment service with your back end and the stuff that you're doing in Lightroom. You can find out more at Uploading Photos on Zenfolio.com, and I have a link in the show notes. All right, let's do a little virtual camera club news. So I want to talk about the workshops just for a second. The reserve list, which, you know, I announced the workshops last week, and the reserve list is off to a great start. And I just wanted to share, you know, which workshop got the most names in the first week. So we have four workshops. We have Reinvent the Wedding for those that want to do wedding photography. We have San Francisco Street Shooting. We have Point Reyes National Seashore. And we have Fall Color in the Eastern Sierra. You have a guess on which one got the most reserved names the first week? They all did well. They all got quite a few names, but one of them got more than the other three. All right, I'm going to tell you right now. So the one that got the most names the first week was Point Reyes National Seashore event in August of 2016. So that's kind of cool. So this is our first visit to this location. So if you're looking for a satisfying summer adventure, go over to the TDS Workshops page for more information. And we have the workshops link in the top nav bar. Or you could just go to thedigitalstory.com/workshops. And you can enter your name on the reserve list for the workshop or workshops that you're interested in
Those on the reserve list, they get first crack at the workshop when it's time to send out the registration forms. All right, and I will be honest with you, some workshops never get to the public. We fill them up with the reserve list. A holiday note from the folks at SizzlePix. Yes, it's time to start thinking about this. So the 5K ultra high definition SizzlePix order received over the next few weeks can be guaranteed to beat the rush and be delivered for the holidays. And this is a great gift for the person who has everything, right? A meaningful photo from you on a high definition SizzlePix. I mean, how can you beat that combination? If you'd like to have additional copies for gifts or for yourself, you can do that. You just order any two SizzlePix to be shipped together, and they'll give you 20% off the second one. And that's from sizes 18 inches up to a mind-boggling 48 by 72 inches. 6 feet. Can you imagine a 6-foot SizzlePix? Woo! Now that's what I call making a statement. Anyway, all you got to do is go to sizzlepix.com, SIZZLPIX.com. They have a tile on all the pages of the digital store. Don't procrastinate too long on getting your holiday gifts going. And if you can't figure out what to get that special someone, I'll tell you, a SizzlePix will make them smile. Get it in the works now. Check it off your list. And you know what? While you're at it, get an extra one for yourself and save 20%. A note from Red River Paper. Well, Photo Plus is coming up, right? It's coming up October 22 through 24. And the good folks at Red River Paper, they're going to be there in booth 1158. 1158. Go by and see them. Say hello. Tell them that you're from the Digital Story. Tell them that you're part of our photography community. Drew will probably be there. Say hey to Drew. I think he's one of the nicest guys in the photo business. And they have two new paper editions for 2016. They'll have them at the show. They'll have samples. Go by, take a look, see what they're up to. Talk about printing, talk about paper. Get excited about printing. Come away with some samples and then come home and do some work. You will not regret it. I'm telling you right now, making a print is one of the most satisfying things you can do in photography. Red River Paper has a tile on all the pages of the Digital Story, and they have a terrific Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. And finally, I want to let you know I'm working on a new title for lynda.com, and it is Photos for OS 10 Essential Training. And you know what? I'm having fun with this title. I'm loving working on it. I'm in the middle of it right now. And one of the things that I'm enjoying about it is that this app is more capable than I initially thought. When you really start digging into it, you'll learn that. We'll have this title up by the end of the year. And so if you're thinking about photos either to augment your existing workflow or recommending to someone who needs a powerful yet simple way to manage their pictures, you have automatic cloud storage, you have all sorts of goodies, this would be a good training. And in the meantime, I do have an up and running training for Photos for OS 10. You can look at that right now. All of that is at lynda.com, lynda.com. All right, that's going to do it for this week. I know we ran long, but it was worth it because we had such a cool interview. I really appreciate having Brian on the show. I've got another good interview coming up. I might run it next week or the week after. I've got so many good things going on. We're going to be talking about Photo Plus. We'll be talking about the fall workshop. We'll be talking about some new camera gear. Come back next week. Stay a part of this virtual camera club, this photography community, and get better at your craft. Until next week, take care now. Bye-bye.